upholding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. Were included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And greetings from Technocracy News and Trends. Patrick Wood here, editor-in-chief and founder of Technocracy News and Trends. And today, before we start, I'm going to recenter the needle for you on what technocracy is. And sometimes the articles that get posted on Technocracy News and Trends are so far afield, it's difficult to tie them back to where they all belong originally. Technocracy originally, as it was founded in the 1930s, was to be a replacement economic system for capitalism and free enterprise. They thought at that time, at Columbia University at least, that capitalism was dead, that it would never recover, and that it was up to them, the scientists and engineers, to design a brand new economic system from scratch that would solve all the problems of the world, economically speaking, and it would be run exclusively by them. No elected officials involved, no parliaments, no congresses, no councils of citizens, etc., strictly run by them according to their science. In the Technocracy Study Course, which became their Bible, it was written in 1934, this is how they defined technocracy. It was a science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population. Now, that kind of sounds innocuous. But these are the people who literally invented, at least in a practical sense, at least in a pragmatic sense, the science of social engineering. Well, it's not a science at all. You can't take the hard science discipline and principles of, say, physics, mathematics, biology, etc., and simply apply that to the social mechanism. You can't just take those scientific principles and say, well, we've invented something new here. It's called the science of social engineering. It doesn't invalidate the laws of those various sciences, by the way, but they way overstepped their bounds when they decided they could use all of those techniques to manage society according to how they envisioned society should be managed. So they called it the science of social engineering. And this is what we have today. Not only is it a replacement economic system, which it still is, we see it now under the name of sustainable development, Agenda 21, 2030 Agenda, etc., all of those things point to a new economic system. But along the way, social engineering comes into play. So all the things that we see that are designed to manipulate, mold, control people is part of this mantra of the science of social engineering. All of these articles that are posted on Technocracy News and Trends fit into that mode. And when I see an article that fits this, it makes sense to me. It may not always make sense to you why it gets posted, but now I'm telling you so you know. Everything that I grab a hold of that gets posted on Technocracy News and Trends relates to the science of social engineering as well as the replacement economic system that we now know currently as sustainable development, aka technocracy. I spent a lot of time in my book, by the way, that is Technocracy, the Hard Road to World Order, explaining why technocracy and sustainable development are one and the same. They're functional equivalents. The world knows it by sustainable development. You also know it by technocracy, because that's really what it is. That's where it started. So the articles we have today are just so strange and so perverse and so twisted that it's almost impossible to express the disgust that some of you will feel when I present the headline to this first article. And it reads like this. Professor in Sweden, this is a professor now, professor of economics, actually. Professor in Sweden suggests, quote, eating human flesh to save the climate. You heard me right. Eating human flesh to save the climate. I wrote at the top of this article, the 1973 movie Soylent Green, some of you will remember that movie, has become a cult movie since, with a very devout following of people, not for the sake of eating flesh, but just for the sake of dystopia. I wrote, the 1973 movie Soylent Green, starring Charlton Heston and Edward G. Robinson, ended with the desperate proclamation, "It's people! It's people!" referring to society's primary food source, Soylent Green. That was the food product that they ate, called Soylent Green. And the hero of the movie, Charlton Heston, who played a hard-nosed police officer, detective, he discovered that Soylent Green was being made with people. That is, people who have died. It was a shocking movie, and here's what the article states. Oftentimes, the climate alarmists are their own worst enemy. It sounds reasonable enough that carbon emissions might have an impact on the climate, but it's a rather nasty thing to prove, especially when alarmist predictions fail over and over again. It's far from the, quote, scientific consensus. But the alarmists don't tone down their rhetoric. They ratchet it up to 11. They want to take away your plastic straws, your cars, your burgers. Then there's this behavioral scientist in Sweden who wants to eat human flesh to deal with the effects of climate change. No, this isn't the Onion or the Babylon Bee. This is a Swedish professor appearing on Swedish television advocating for cannibalism because climate change is just that dire. It can't be lunacy if it's done in the name of climate change, can it? Earlier this week, Magnus Söderlund, professor of marketing and strategy at the Stockholm School of Economics, spoke at the Gastro Summit, a discussion on the future of food in the case of a climate apocalypse. The Epoch Times reported this story, by the way. Söderlund spoke on the topic, quote, "Can you imagine eating human flesh?" close quote. He argued for breaking down the ancient taboos against desecrating the human corpse and, well, cannibalism. The clip is available on state Swedish television channel TV4. There's a link to that. If you can understand Swedish, you can go there and listen to it. The end of the video's description roughly translates to, quote, "the possibility of eating human flesh to save the climate. How cannibalism would have any impact on the climate is anyone's guess. But it seems the professor is more focused on dealing with the after effects of climate change anyway." According to the Epoch Times, Söderlund dismissed taboos against cannibalism as conservative. He suggested that people's resistance to eating human flesh could be overcome little by little, beginning with persuading people to just taste it. In the video, he warned, quote, "that since food sources will be scarce in the future, people must be introduced to eating things they have thus far considered disgusting, among them human flesh." While the professor also discussed breaking other taboos on eating pets and insects, his talk focused on cannibalism. According to his bio, Söderlund's research focuses on consumer behavior. Can we think social engineering here, by the way? Reactions to marketing stimuli and also psychological reactions. Taking the psychological approach, the professor said people can be tricked into making the right decisions. So we need to trick people into eating human flesh like Soylent Green? Sounds to me. This is absolutely unplugged. The lowest of the low. The basest of the base. There is no way to describe how morally and ethically disgusting this is, and especially to relate it to climate change. Is there no level too low for these people to go? The worst part is many people listen to his speech and many people will think it's wonderful. Well, it's about time. And I suppose in one sense, this gets right down to the base of the United Nations Sustainable Development Program, because the whole goal of depopulation of the world is to reduce the resource demand that the remaining population has. It's putting population in balance with resources. Some have suggested, even within the United Nations, that the world is only really able to maintain about 1 billion people. Well, that's a far cry from the 7+ billion people we have on planet Earth now. But they say if we get down to that level, the Earth has a chance of replenishing itself to the point where the remaining 1 billion people can survive. This is absolute nonsense, of course. The Earth has been able to provide for people very well and for large populations. But they believe that the best way to get rid of carbon dioxide is simply to get rid of the carbon-based units that breathe carbon dioxide out. And you know who that is? That's you and me. As you breathe out right now, you're breathing carbon dioxide. And in these people's minds, shame on you. You're a carbon-based unit that's destroying the atmosphere and destroying planet Earth. And if you don't watch it, we're going to get our knife and fork out and eat you. Well, that's a little crazy. But this professor is not just a little crazy. He's absolutely lost touch with humanity. He's lost touch with reality, suggesting it's a good thing to eat people. The next story is not as disgusting, but it's just as strange. Silicon Valley technocrats intend to settle the moon. Yes, they do. I would dare anyone, by the way, to look at these moon-crazy technocrats from Silicon Valley, and China too, for that matter, and try to justify labeling them as communist, socialist, or Marxist. It just doesn't fit. And you know why? Because they're not communist, socialist, or Marxist. They are technocrats. Here's the story. The moon is all the rage these days. China wants to send people there. So too does the United States and NASA. In fact, just about every country with a space program has some sort of lunar ambition that they hope will play out over the next few years. Now there's a new entrant in this new space race, a nonprofit organization called the Open Lunar Foundation. That's Open Lunar Foundation, not Open Lunatic Foundation, by the way. Lunar, L-U-N-A-R, referring to the moon. Based in San Francisco, this figures, it's a group made up of tech executives and engineers, many of them with former ties to NASA, who have serious ambitions to create a lunar settlement. The driving ethos behind the foundation is to start a development that would not be beholden to a particular country or billionaire. Instead, as the group's name suggests, Open Lunar wants to create technology for exploring and living on the moon as a type of collaborative effort. The director of policy and governance for the Open Lunar Society said, "Our highest ambition is catalyzing and enabling a peaceful and cooperative lunar settlement. At this time, when there are so many commercial and government actors advancing their efforts on the moon, we are excited to demonstrate a civic approach to participation." Open Lunar began a few years ago as something of a thought exercise. A group of friends in Silicon Valley were taking stock of the dramatic improvement in aerospace technology, along with the falling cost of rocket launches, thanks to companies like Elon Musk's Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, that's SpaceX, and Peter Beck's Rocket Lab. The friends came to the realization that it might soon be possible to create a small lunar settlement for about $2 billion to $3 billion. And that's a hefty sum, but a very achievable one in the era that abounds with wealthy space enthusiasts. And so, the friends decided to explore the idea of going to the moon in earnest. The picture that emerged out of those meetings was that you could create a permanent, economically self-sustaining presence on the moon that could be done for the single-digit billions, says Steve Jurvetson, a venture capitalist who provided the initial Open Lunar funding. "I got excited by the idea and the compelling nature of the people involved." Some of the most prominent members of the group include astronaut Chris Hadfield, who has spent time on the International Space Station, Will Marshall and Robbie Schlinger, co-founders of the satellite maker Planet Labs Incorporated, Simon Pete Warden, a former director of NASA's Ames Research Center, and Jurvetson, who has invested in both SpaceX and Planet Labs. Hadfield is listed as the director of Open Lunar in nonprofit filings, while the others are advisors to the foundation. These individuals, along with dozens of other people, have spent the last 18 months meeting in private, trying to figure out what sort of early missions would make the most sense. Working ideas include smaller, cheaper missions to put various probes and robotic systems on the lunar surface rather than one massive mission. Lunar activity is exploding, Jesse Kate Schlinger said. There are governments and companies intensely focused on going, but there is no third pillar representing the possibility of doing things differently. If we don't roll up our sleeves and get involved, then by definition, the future of human settlement in space will reflect the status quo of those currently in power. To see things done differently on the moon, we had to start experimenting now. Now, this brings up an interesting point. I'll close on this article with this. The talk about defining the future of human settlement in space as being a reflection of the status quo of those currently in power clearly indicates that these people, those lunar wannabes, are certainly not in sync with those people who are currently in power. They represent a different power structure in the world. They're technocrats. Technocrats have no use for human government whatsoever. And you can see in this statement their disdain for human government. They want to colonize space according to their own ideas of technocracy, where things will simply be run by science and everything else somehow will just be copacetic. They'll all just get along. Everything will be cool. All the systems will function. We'll see how this turns out. My only regret, I think, on this story is that they're not talking more about Mars. Mars is a lot further away from planet Earth, and should any of those people decide to go to Mars themselves, there's a much less chance that they'll return. This is crazy. You just can't make this stuff up. The last story is disturbing, not disgusting. My headline of this story is woof. Geofencing used to corral people, e-scooters, e-bikes, and cars. Even if you don't own a pet, I'm sure by this time that everybody understands the concept of an electronic fence. These are very popular with dog owners. You simply bury a wire out around the perimeter of your yard that has a current in it, usually just an electric current, maybe an RF current. And then you equip the dog with a collar that is sensitive to the frequency of that wire. And it sets up a boundary for the pet so that when they approach that barrier, they receive a signal, sometimes even a buzzer or maybe even a mild electric shock, to make them go back and don't cross that barrier. It's called a geofence. It's a geographical fence. It's also invisible, of course. You can't see it because you bury the wire. Well, in this case, I wrote, geofencing technology is well known to pet owners who want to keep their dogs inside their yard. But now it is being implemented to control the geospatial limitation of people and the vehicles they drive. Geofencing may be fine for animals like dogs and livestock, but people are not animals. This dystopian technology will be the capstone of total population control. And I'll only add to that, just you wait. The article says, geofencing is a virtual fencing created around the desired boundary locations of a land. Geofencing primarily consists of the software programs which are executed using the data gathered from GPS, that's a global positioning system, or the RFID, that's radio frequency identification. The data includes the location details as per the geographic parameters of the person's equipment. The primary factor responsible for the increasing popularity of geofencing is that it allows an administrator who has set up the geofencing to set up the triggers for events. These triggers are set up by the administrator for the events such as entry or exit of the devices within the decided boundaries by the administrator. Also, geofencing is getting increasingly popular due to the many applications in corporations such as Google Earth. The incorporation allows the administrators to define the boundaries for geofencing on top of a satellite view as per specific geographical area, which is available to Google Earth. The application then defines where you can and cannot go. The applications for this are wide-ranging, as the article states. It can be used, for instance, on e-scooters and e-bikes to keep them within a certain boundary, a certain number of blocks, for instance. In one case, geofencing is being used to dramatically throttle the speed available to the e-bikes and e-scooters when they roam outside of the area that they're supposed to be in. In other words, they just slow down to a crawl, which of course means it's useless to you at that point, so you might as well just go back where you can go at full speed. And they're talking about using this for cars, for other types of autonomous vehicles, and there's a whole long report on all the applications on how geofencing could be used to corral humans, people, their vehicles, their cars, their e-bikes, their e-scooters, their motorcycles, whatever, and that it could effectively be integrated with apps that include access to artificial intelligence systems that could define where you can and cannot go. You need to let that sink in just for a minute. Maybe I see this a little more clearly, but the risk here is that when coupled with artificial intelligence and a virtual map of the world using GPS, you could be limited from entering or exiting any particular part of real estate in the world. This will be the last frontier if they perfect it. They already have a number of ways to nudge people into certain behaviors, like on Google and Amazon and so on. That's marketing-based data. But from a dystopian point of view, for those who would want to control people and keep them within certain boundaries, for instance, within a city or a certain number of blocks or whatever, geofencing literally could be the last frontier of human population control. Well, if you haven't had a chance to read my book, Technocracy, The Hard Road to World Order, or to listen to the audiobook that's just been released recently, it's available on Amazon.com. You can go there and get a copy of the audiobook, listen at your leisure. When you're in a car, you're driving, you're sitting at home relaxing, whatever. Or you have a copy of the book and you put that in your lap and you listen to the book while you read along. It's a wonderful way to really pick up on everything in the book. So if you haven't had access to this knowledge, now sure is the time to do it. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. We'll see you next time.